Hi, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of Beyond Infidelity with David Fetter. David, welcome to Beyond Infidelity, your first show.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. It's great to be here. How you doing?
I'm doing great, and we've done a lot of programs with you in the past, but we're doing this whole new series called Beyond Infidelity, and we have a preview show if our listeners want to go back in the archive and listen to what this is all about. But you want to jump right into this right now, and the show is all yours. Take it over, David.
Thanks, Steve. I just wanted to start by letting people know that I believe that most people can not only stay together in their committed relationship after infidelity, but that people can get beyond infidelity and create a relationship with their spouse where they not only survive, but thrive. And that's really, a tremendously important focus of mine in my practice, because, a lot of people talk about settling in their relationships. And, I believe that when people just settle in their relationship, They're looking for some kind of trouble in the future because they're not really going to be happy. What I want people to do is recover, survive, and thrive. Mm-hmm. And based on my experience in my practice, what people are desperate for and needing is a roadmap that enables them to get beyond infidelity, hence the name of the program. So in this podcast, what we're going to do is point out the factors that are required for a successful recovery for both the participating partner and the hurt partner. And this is based on my practice and my empirical experience with working with, hundreds, if not thousands of couples that I've had the opportunity to meet. When I decided to dedicate my practice to helping people recover from infidelity, I made that decision believing wholeheartedly that more people were ending their relationship after infidelity than was necessary, and they were doing this prematurely. And I was wondering about why that happens, because what I realized is that they had no idea how to overcome the pain they felt and the mistrust they had for their partner. Mm-hmm. Recently, what I've done, I did an interesting exercise where I did a very, very brief statistical analysis of the breakdown of the couples that I've worked with. And what I found is that 62% of the couples who become my clients not only survive and stay together, but they actually get to a better place as a result of the process of working through the challenges that come with recovering from infidelity.
Interesting. Is that because of their willingness to get into this?
I think it's a function of many, many different factors. And what we're going to do here in the podcast is look at some of the characteristics that I've identified in what makes a successful recovery for both the participating partner and the hurt partner. Mm-hmm. And, in hopes that the listeners, when they look at this or listen to the list that I provide, they're going to sort of evaluate where they're at in the list. And if they're, seeing another therapist or even just contemplating what to do, they, can review the list and, as I say, see where they stand and see what might be missing that might be getting in the way of a successful recovery. But some of the, one of the factors that I will talk about, and since you asked about it, I'm going to mention it now, is that what people really need to avoid is allowing hopelessness to seep into the process, because you can think about whether we're talking about infidelity or just about anything else in life. When we start to feel hopeless and also helpless about creating a change or moving forward, that's when things really get derailed and fall apart. Mm-hmm. So as we go on, along, I think that the answer to your question will become more clear.
Good.
So I thought about, you know, how this happened, you know, with, you know, when I talked about the 62% of people who are recovering in a successful way, I wondered about how it happened and wondered whether there was something special or unique about these couples that survived infidelity versus the couples who didn't. And as I said, I've created this list that we'll talk about. And I consider the list to be a series of prerequisites for moving a couple out of the free fall of infidelity and into recovery and onto the path that leads in the direction, rather, of having, you know, what I'd like to call an extraordinary life. And, you know, people listening might think that that's really, you know, far out there. But it is possible. It is a distinct possibility. So I'd like people to, you know, remain open to that possibility, you know, as we go forward. And, you know, I can't emphasize enough that these are, in my opinion, the minimal requirements that must be present for a successful recovery. So, you know, I was looking at I like reading quotes. And, you know, I came across four quotes that I think are worth sharing because they describe the mindset that is necessary to achieve what I'm talking about in this podcast. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is the quotes come from a variety of, you know, people in a variety of backgrounds. One quote is by a 19th century novelist, Louisa May Alcott. Another, Suzanne Wayne, a present-day novelist. The third, Lemony Snicket, a current writer, musician, and novelist. And the last quote is from Colin Powell, a former four-star general of the United States Army. Louisa May Alcott wrote, "I'm not afraid of storms, for I'm learning how to sail my ship." Suzanne Wayne wrote, "Your life is an occasion. Rise to it." Lemony Snicket wrote, "What might seem to be a series of unfortunate events may in fact be the first steps of a journey." And finally, Colin Powell wrote, "Spend a moment watching the old train disappear, then start a new journey on a new train." Mm. Each quote reminds us of the reality that life is forever changing. It overflows with endless challenges. And when faced with adversity, we can be a victim to those circumstances. Or we can, as Louisa May Alcott said, not be afraid of the storm and to learn how to sail your ship. Meanwhile, you know, when I thought about Lemony Snicket and Colin Powell, I thought what they're telling us is when faced with adversity and challenge, to begin a new journey of discovery, personal insight, and growth. And, you know, I think we can go both ways. You know, we can go, when faced with challenges, we can, as many people do, we can become victims to the situation and get stuck in, you know, feeling, you know, how, or really what some people refer to as a pity party or feeling sorry for themselves. And while I think after infidelity, there is a component of that, you know, we are going to feel sort of in the doldrums of, you know, whatever the situation is, or we're going to feel as though we've been hard done by and we've been hurt. And, mm-hmm. and that's because we have been.
Yeah.
But, you know, the people who successfully recover are people who can, you know, after a while of grieving the loss of the old relationship, they're able to step away from being victim and step away from just feeling or focusing on their pain and their hurt, but moving forward into, okay, what can I discover? What can I learn about myself or or my partner? And how do I grow? And, you know, I think that that's true whether, you know, I said 62% of people are successful in their recovery in my practice, but that still leaves, you know, many people who move on alone. And I feel that the discovery, the self-discovery, the personal insight and the growth, they need to do that. We need to do that even if we move on alone. So what are the prerequisites to recovery after an affair? I think it's important to point out that that a good part of the recovery process, and particularly during the early phase of recovery, just after disclosure or discovery of the affair, you know, I don't want there to be any confusion that it's the participating partner who will have to make the majority of the effort. And the reason I say this is because when it doesn't happen, it's a red flag that, you know, that person just isn't ready to either support the hurt partner in the way that they need to be supported, or to do participate effectively in couples work. But the reason why this is so important is, you know, for the participating partner to do the majority of the work, especially early on after discovery or disclosure, is because the participating partner has to, I don't know if I should reuse the word prove or convince the hurt partner that they are a good risk to move forward with.
Right.
If they're not doing that, if they're not making the effort, then, and they're, you know, often one of the things we need to deal with early on in recovery in this work, and I do it in my practice, is you know, discourage the participating partner from focusing on the hurt partner as being the reason for the affair. You know, it's not uncommon. I was going to say it's very common, but it's not uncommon for the participating partner to say, well, you know, I wasn't getting enough sex, or or, you know, you weren't fulfilling my needs in some way. And that really needs to be discouraged. And when a person such as the participating partner falls into that place, then, you know, in reality, what they're doing is they're either purposely or accidentally blaming the hurt partner for their decision to go outside the committed relationship. So we need to discourage that very early on. And it's the participating partner who needs to do the majority of the work early on to convince the hurt partner that they're a good risk.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at the 12, what I call the 12 necessary characteristics, excuse me, of the participating partner. These are people who accept ownership for their choice to be unfaithful, because infidelity is a choice. It's except in very, very, shall we say, unusual circumstances where someone might be suffering from a psychiatric illness such as bipolar 2. In that situation, it's not as much a choice than it is a condition of the condition of bipolar 2. But in the majority of couples, at least that I work with, it is a choice to go outside the committed relationship. So that would be one of the characteristics. The next is they uncover the reason or reasons for why the affair happened, and they participate in treatment to correct this. And just as I suggested, some infidelity occurs as secondary to a psychiatric illness such as clinical depression or bipolar 2. Participating in treatment may involve a psychiatric assessment, and they're open to that. They are also open to examining what or who they value and how they may have lost their focus. I try to stay away from labels such as narcissist and so on. I prefer to talk about how you may have lost your focus. The whole concept of what you value is something that came to me one day while I was walking on the street. And it was quite interesting because I was walking by all these people walking up and down the street, nobody saying hello to anybody, nobody really showing you know, any indication that they value the people that are walking by.
Mm-hmm.
And when I realized that, I started to make a habit of, you know, when I was passing somebody and our eyes caught one another for a moment, I make it my business to to, you know, say hi to them because I value them as a person. And, you know, I thought of that with regards to infidelity, and I was thinking, when a person goes outside their marriage or their committed relationship and makes a decision to do so, they're not valuing their partner. Many of us go through life not even valuing ourselves. You know, we don't exercise enough, we don't sleep enough, we don't eat proper foods, we drink too much, things like that. It's really getting back in touch with you know, what the participating partner values in life. And I feel that that creates a foundation from which to move forward. Yeah. The next is they end the affair, and they do so properly, which is in a clear and decisive manner with the affair partner. So there's no confusion or thought in the affair partner's mind that there's a possibility that the affair may start up again if, let's say, the person's marriage doesn't work out. It's ended in a very definite and decisive manner. The participating partner will also develop a plan that they commit to, and in committing to the plan, they resist the urge of going back to the affair partner. It's not enough, in my view, it's not enough for the people I work with to just say, well, they're not going to cheat again, or they're not going to step outside their marriage, they're not going to contact the affair partner again. They need, in my view, they need to have a well thought out plan that they can, as I said, commit to and use to resist any urges to go back to the affair partner, because those urges will exist. Mm-hmm. The next is they accept counseling to help process emotions such as the anger, the shame, the fear, judgment, and grief that they will feel, as well as other emotions that are undoubtedly going to surface. And the critical piece there is grief, that when a person has an affair and they develop a relationship with the affair partner, it's not just for sex. It's probably because they feel that some of their emotional needs are being met in the affair. So there's going to be a grief process that they need to complete in order to really emotionally separate from the affair partner. That's really something that can't be avoided, or shouldn't be avoided. Next is they accept responsibility for how deeply they hurt how deeply they hurt their partner and caused all levels of grief and question and uncertainty in the hurt partner's life. So as a result, they answer the questions that the hurt partner has. They share details about the affair, and they avoid staggered disclosures, which are, we'll talk about it in a few minutes, one of the hurdles that needs to be overcome. Staggered disclosures, for anybody who's curious, are when the participating partner shares a little bit about the affair at a time. The problem there is that while they are sharing the information and they feel as though they're being honest, each time they share a little bit more, the hurt partner believes, this is it, now I know it all. And then they learn a little bit more, and each time they learn a little bit more, they get re-traumatized as a result. So we want to really, avoid staggered disclosures, and participating partners who successfully recover avoid staggered disclosures. They accept that recovery can't be rushed, and they give their partner, the hurt partner, the time they take in order to recover. And they make the commitment that they are not going to abandon the hurt partner regardless of how long it takes. And they also do so without making the hurt partner feel guilty or bad. They illustrate, next point is they illustrate compassion, understanding, remorse, and empathy. And sometimes in order to do that, those earlier emotions of anger, shame, fear, judgment, etc., need to be processed first before the compassion, understanding, remorse, and empathy will surface. They take whatever steps are required to rebuild trust, and that could include, you know, giving the hurt partner a password to their email accounts, sharing their text messages, letting the person, the hurt partner, look at their cell phone, and in some cases, install a tracking device on their cell phone, or even, as some people have done, hire a private eye to follow them around, because if they're not doing anything, they have nothing to fear anyways. So they do this because they want to help the hurt partner feel more stable and more secure. And as I said earlier, prove to them that they're a good risk. They ride the inevitable ups and down cycle that recovery takes. There's going to be good days followed by bad days. Could happen on the same day. They need to be able to ride that wave. And finally, they are authentic and real, which is, you know, one might say obvious, but not always easy to do. Then there's the hurt partner and their 12 necessary characteristics to be a successful, you know, to successfully recover. They're able to accept that their thoughts, feelings, fears, and concerns are normal. They need to be able to express their feelings in a productive manner, and using I messages can be very helpful. They take the time to process their emotions, just like the participating partner feels emotions, so does the hurt partner. The hurt partner's emotions may include betrayal, anger, fear, confusion, sadness, rage, and so on. Not always easy, but they avoid making demeaning comments when speaking to their partner. You know, it's important to be able to process your emotions and then be able to express how you feel in a way that is productive and not necessarily demeaning or to cause the participating partner to feel more shame or feel more guilt. They focus on what they can control by establishing healthy boundaries and consequences. A lot of people who are not progressing in the recovery process, what I find is they're focused on what they can't control. So it's really important to focus on what you can control and to do so by establishing, as I said, healthy boundaries and consequences. Next point is that they're able to ask for what they need, including reassurances, and they do so without criticism. So, you know, the participating partner is not shooting in the dark. If something is helpful, ask for it. And don't criticize or judge the participating partner for not having provided that. You know, assuming that because they haven't, they don't care. They may just not know. They may not realize what's helpful. So to be able to do so without criticism and judgment, they tell their spouse, it's an extension of the same point. And they, when they have identified what's helpful, they request more of the same. So it's happening more and more, and you know, the couple is now working as a team together. Just as the participating partner needs to ride the up and down wave of recovery, the hurt partner also expects obstacles to occur, and when they happen, knows how to deal with them. And that I should have actually added to the participating partner with the ups and downs. During the downs, they work to know how to navigate through those downtimes. The hurt partner stays focused. And there's a therapist in the United States who I'm studying with, actually, his process. And his name is Terry Real. And he says, keep your eye on the prize. And I interpret that as keeping focused on what you want, and they reach a point where they're able to practice acceptance that the affair is something that happened in the past. It's not happening in the present. and hence it's not something that can hurt them in the present. Next point is they refrain from making any final decisions regarding their marriage or committed relationship for a minimum of 4 to 6 months to allow the therapy to really take hold. And sometimes, in some cases, this may require the drafting of a therapeutic separation agreement, which is not a legal separation agreement, but a therapeutic separation agreement. And, you know, I think what I will do is, in a future podcast, talk a little bit about what a therapeutic separation agreement includes and how it could be helpful. Next point is they avoid falling into and staying in the victim position. I talked a little bit about that already. And the last point is they practice good self-care regarding their daily needs. Early on in the recovery process, what is the best living arrangement? What are the best sleeping arrangements? They create or develop a good, healthy support system, and they may get into, and I hope they would, get into yoga, meditation, mindfulness, and practice those skills, because they're very, very helpful in the recovery process. So what we just discussed and just very briefly reviewed is really what my version of the main characteristics of hurt partners and participating partners who are successfully healing from the trauma of infidelity. But just before, you know, we move on, I want to talk about five of what I call are the common recovery hurdles that if they are present, can interfere with the recovery process and undermine the process. The common recovery hurdles are ambivalence of the participating partner to end the affair, unrelenting anger of the hurt partner, if the affair doesn't truly end, which is connected to the first hurdle of ambivalence. I mentioned staggered disclosures and the impatience, when impatience is shown by the participating partner, that the hurt partner is not getting better fast enough. And as you'll recall in the characteristics of the participating partner, you know, one of those characteristics is committing to stay in there for the long haul and not pressure the hurt partner to recover any faster than they're recovering. So any one or combination of the recovery hurdles can sabotage the recovery process, as I mentioned, and any that exist really have to be addressed directly. So, you know, this could be in therapy, this could be, you know, if the hurt partner is feeling, you know, that one of these hurdles is present, they should bring it to the, you know, to their spouse's attention. Or any of these hurdles should be addressed, as I said, in therapy. So, you know, in summary, my belief, as I said earlier, is that in many cases, couples can work to stay together, and as I said, you know, not only survive but thrive. And going back to one of the, you know, to the question you asked earlier, Steve, it takes commitment, yeah. It takes dedication, it takes work. In spite of the up and down nature of the recovery process, and it requires, as I said earlier, for both spouses to remain hopeful, as opposed to hopeless about their future. It's very common for people to feel helpless. You know, sometimes people, you know, the participating partner will turn to me and say, look, you know, there's only one way to say I love you. There's only one way to say I care. There's only one way to say I won't cheat again. There's only one way to say I won't hurt you again in this way. Because when you say it, it all sounds the same. And this is what a number of people have said to me, and it's true. But it's a combination of not only saying it, but that committing to the you know, to all of those other points that I said are part of the successful, you know, the participants, the participating partner and her partner who recover successfully. And, you know, when people talk to me that way, they talk about, you know, what they're really saying is I feel helpless. And that we then work through in the therapy, because what I find is that if people are creative, people think outside of the box, people are remaining committed, and people are remaining dedicated, over time, the hurt partner will start to see that the participating partner is being sincere this time. And that changes, you know, you can't change how it sounds, but it changes how it feels. So before we finish, I just want to end with one Buddhist quote, one more quote, and this is a Buddhist quote that describes a major component of recovery. It's, do not dwell in the past. Do not dream of the future. Concentrate the mind on the present moment. I find that with the people, you know, there are phases of recovery. What we talked about today are the characteristics that are necessary to recover successfully, or certainly to increase the probability of that. But we also, you know, need to eventually stop dwelling on what happened in the past, i.e. the affair, and start looking and living in the present moment of what is happening between the hurt partner and the participating partner. One of the, you know, another hurdle that I just want to, you know, finish off with is when the hurt partner is unable to open up to the possibility of slowly but surely, and I believe and I agree that sometimes it's incremental because the pain and the hurt of the infidelity is so great, but opening up slowly and gradually to the possibility that this time it's different.
Right. And to me, David, I mean, this is such a tough time for people, right, when they're going through the situation. And what your practice offers and what you very eloquently stated throughout this program is that there is hope. And it's not just about surviving, but the potential to actually thrive. And to our listeners, David Fetter is an expert in affair recovery. That's what he does. That's his practice. He has a website that is mylifeafteranaffair.com that I highly recommend you go to, mylifeafteranaffair.com. And that's where you can reach out to David. He consults with clients from all over the world via Skype or in person if you happen to live in Canada, Toronto specifically, I believe your area. David, maybe let people know what it's like to call you, reach out, and what's the process?
Well, as you mentioned, there's multiple ways to reach out and to get in touch with me. On my website, people can request if they wanted to meet and spend an hour together. We can do that through the computer if people are outside of the Toronto area, or they could also request a free 15-minute consultation where they tell me, you know, whatever it is they wish to get some direction on, and we spend a little bit of time, or I spend a little bit of time getting to know their situation and giving them that direction. So people can reach out by, you know, scheduling that appointment online by going to my website. They could send me an email at david@closeconnections.ca. And I'll respond to them. They can call me at 416-315-5107. And on my website, they could also sign up for a newsletter that I send out approximately once a month, where I talk about some issue related to infidelity that I feel that people would be interested in and would be helpful to them. So there's all sorts of ways to get in touch. And for people who are in the Toronto area, you know, I have an office where I could would welcome people to come in and meet.
Is it best that they meet with you one-on-one, or do they normally bring their partner along with them?
Well, it really depends on a lot of the work is couple work, but you know, occasionally when people are in a place where they're not, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, emotionally in a place where they can, you know, let's say speak in express themselves to their partner in a productive way, for example, because their anger is getting the better of them, or if for the participating partner, if they feel, you know, so much shame and guilt that they're not even able to speak, then you know, that would, both of those would be indicators for individual therapy. But you know, but it's also important for the participating partner to really understand why they did what they did in the first place. So usually before I do couple work, I start with some individual work so that the, you know, the parties have a little bit more insight into you know, where they're coming from, and for the participating partner, how they got to having the affair, because that's one of the most common and important questions for the hurt partner to understand how their partner got to the place of you know, committing this affair.
Right. Well, thank you so much for all you do and for doing this podcast for our listeners. These programs will be available, and new ones come out about every month. And if you'd like to subscribe, you can just simply go to iTunes. You can subscribe to the podcast there, or you can hear it from our website, divorcesourceradio.com. We're also available on Stitcher and iTunes Radio. And if you have a smart television, a lot of these have those apps built into them. I know on my smart TV, I have a TuneIn Radio, and you can listen to David's program right there. So again, thank you, David, for all you do, and I look forward to our next program.
Thanks very much, Steve.